You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is actually me, and I am going to be interviewed by Jonathan Hochberg, who is coming to kind of help me wear the other shoe, as it were. So I will go through some of the same experiences as my guests, but also so that you may know something of where I'm coming from on the show, which you hear bits and pieces of my life, but not necessarily about my work.
And I'm very honored and glad to be here to serve this capacity.
So Jonathan, thank you for volunteering to do this. I really appreciate the support you've given the show over the years and being on the show yourself. Anyway, so I'm going to let you take over the question piece, and I will sit here and try to run the board.
Sure. Well, as a guest, I have always enjoyed being part of the process that is made of clay, and as a listener, I have always appreciated the depth to which you you delve into people's personalities and their interactions with the world, and so in the spirit of turning the tables on you and bringing out your depths and personality, let's start with the basic question of who are you?
Well, and I didn't realize this question was going to make me squirm as much as it did, but I am an intensely curious person. I can find something interesting about almost anything, and I am almost never bored. The only time I'm bored is when I'm depressed. And in this curiosity, I grew up in a rural subsistence farm family, but we were fascinated by the wider world. We had three sets of encyclopedias. We brought people from Kansas City and St. Louis, whites and blacks, and people onto the farm, even though we didn't have much, but we welcomed people. And this was a kind of a rural life that was really open to the wider world. So that's where I got started. And that curiosity is both very fun. It tends to encourage me to reach out to people that I don't necessarily agree with or even maybe in complete conflict with. But it's encouraged me to form relationships where most people don't think about that as a possibility. It also resulted in a surgeon once elbowing me in the forehead because part of my training as a chaplain was to observe open heart surgery and to meet the patient the day before the surgery and to meet with them afterwards, but to witness the surgery. And the surgeon that I was observing was one of the first people to do open heart surgery in the U.S. And this was at the end of his career in the 1980s. And I was leaning over the operating table so far to get a good look inside that I was getting in the way of his operating with the scalpel, and so he elbows me in the forehead. But I tend to be wanting to see what's going on, wanting to know how it works, and in a certain kind of way, I enjoy people, and I've never met a person that I could not find something interesting about.
So you say that you had several encyclopedia sets.
Yes.
And you had people coming in from all over.
Yeah.
You also say that you lived in a rural environment. What sort of mass media exposure did you have as a child?
Oh, and that actually was really intense because my first conscious exposure to mass media was the radio.
Right.
And in 1964, when I started first grade, buses had radios playing in them it took, 10 minutes to get to school, but it took 50 minutes to get home at the end of the day because of the way the route ran. And I listened and I knew every song that came out on WHB, which is a high power station out of Kansas City. I knew every song that came out and when it came out from about 1964 to probably 1974 or 5 or 6, shortly before when I left for to be an exchange student and for college. Because that was my introduction. And then we didn't have regular television access because we counted on hand-me-down televisions from other people who got better sets, but we would get their hand-me-down, and as long as it worked until it broke, we might get, ABC News from St. Joe, Missouri, or Kansas City, or KCMO,
sure.
And I think it was in a CBS, or I don't know what it was station. But anyway, that was my media exposure. But I also remember watching a whole lot of Vietnam War clips,
right.
And they were not edited. You know, they did not have this notion that you really seriously censor the violence. No. And that, but also growing up on a farm where we slaughtered our own animals and where we, you know, did all the animal health care and castration and all this stuff ourselves, that kind of stuff was not out of my realm of, you know, sensibility.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you, you went off to college.
Well, let me just stay with one piece of the immediate exposure.
Sure.
I remember the 1968 Olympics and the African American athletes, and I'm blocking on their names, who stood up and gave the Black Power salute, and then they were stripped of their medals. That image stuck with me. And that image was something that I incorporated into my days in student government, even in this little white rural school system. And that was very much a part of media exposure. But we had this, to watch the 60s in urban America and the urban world play itself out from this isolated rural place was a really unusual posture.
I can imagine. And you had you were raised by relatively conservative adults.
I was actually raised by the local standards, fairly progressive. And my dad died when I was seven, and my mother was working as a nurse's aide. She didn't have any college. She got some other jobs that made it easier for her, but she never made much more than 20% or 30% above the minimum wage, which was actually worth a whole lot more back in 1968 and 71, 74. They were people who were more open. And much of rural America was more open. I grew up in a congregation, a religious congregation that had fundamentalists, conservatives, liberals, and progressives.
Oh,
we had the national president of the National Farmers Organization in the congregation, but we also had people who were Bible thumping. I learned about moral diversity literally from the cradle.
Uh-huh.
And these people had enough. They had their tensions, they had their fights, but they had a sense that we belong to each other, which is a lot of what we don't have now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how did they filter that tension, that cultural tension in the 60s?
Well, what happened was, at times they tried to kind of fight it out among themselves, but more of the time they tried to create a space where all of those things could exist. Okay. The sense in a high functioning community, everybody needs standing and everybody needs what it takes to thrive. I like to say sometimes that I grew up in a community where people realized even your worst enemy needs what it takes to thrive. So you never beat up on them or damage them in such a way that they can't thrive.
Right.
And that's an attitude that we just don't have in a society or an institutionalized place where it's winner take all.
No, and in fact, the zero sum game that our culture has become is a direct dichotomy to that.
Right. I grew up around people who were odd in that they were the grandchildren and great-grandchildren of people who led the agrarian revolt of the 1870s, who were cooperativists. They were anarchists with a good attitude about other people.
Mm-hmm.
And as opposed to socialists, which are institutionalists, or communists, which are institutionalists, this was this was American-grown way of doing economic equity.
Mm-hmm.
And so those things still echoed through that part of the country. We only became reactionary. Rural areas became increasingly reactionary after, you know, kind of with the depression and then coming out through the 50s. The 50s was a terrible economic depression for agriculture in this country, whereas the urban areas were just exploding.
Right.
And we lost a third of the county's population or a quarter in that decade. Mm-hmm. But from 1900 to 2000, we lost 80%.
Right.
It's just, you know, it's hemorrhaging people. Right.
And you actually left.
I left in 76.
At about that time.
Yeah, I left. I left when things were slowing down a little bit, because for a very brief moment, the oil embargo created a false lifting of the value of farmland, because that's where investment was going. Right. So that's when that was in 73. It began to push things up. In 79, my mother sold the family farm, moved off to have a small ability to retire, married. But a month after she sold the farm for cash, the bottom went out of the price, and the person who bought it lost everything.
Ugh.
And it was a bubble. It was a bubble in much the same way, right, that we saw in 2008. But sure, I witnessed that bubble growing up in rural America.
Right.
And many rural Americans remembered that long before the housing bubble.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
So. Well, do you want to take a break for some music?
Sure, yeah, sure,
let's,
sure.
Let's listen to something. What do you
got? What I've got here is my classmates. You know how when you're in high school, in the high school yearbook, they put either a quote next to you, or in my yearbook, they put a song name. And the one that they chose for me was Carole King's Jazzman.
Oh, all right.
So we're going to play that, and then I have a little bit to... This was more influential on me than I actually realized. Uh-huh. And I was not in the country when they did it, because I was an exchange student in Colombia. I had worked, and because at the minimum wage you could make decent money in those days, right, I was able to pay for my way to be an exchange student.
Huh.
Lift me, won't you lift me above the old routine? Make it nice, lay it.
To WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And today, I, Eric Clay, am the guest, and Jonathan Hochberg is the interviewer, which is a healthy role reversal.
I'm having a lot of fun. So why was Jazzman relevant?
So Jazzman was something that was picked for me, and for many years... this plays into an insecure side of me, but it kind of gets at it. I had a capacity to, well, let me preface this a little bit. I wasn't the best student. I was barely in the top 20% of a class of 42 students.
Okay.
You know, and but I was working 20 to 30 hours a week during the school year and 60 hours in the summer helping support my family.
Right.
And I also was a talker. And I could convince people of stuff and get them to do stuff and encourage them to think about stuff. And I was, but I never viewed myself as having any power, but I just had a presence. And they caught that presence. You know, he can sing you into paradise and bring you to your knees.
Okay.
And what happened to me was that there were a few times where I encouraged people to do something, I don't know, maybe it's as silly as go out and support somebody on something that proved to be a wrong-headed cause. And I learned at a very young age that I could get people to do stuff they shouldn't do.
Okay.
And it kind of makes you doubt your own voice and your own power, which is not a bad thing.
Okay.
Especially with the kind of arrogance that can kind of come with youth.
Sure.
But it hurt me in a powerful sort of way. So I couldn't tell if they were making fun of me or if they were celebrating me, because what happened while I was an exchange student is there had been a major kerfuffle in the school system where the principal of the high school and the superintendent were fired because there had been a significant amount of alcohol caught in the boys' basketball program, particularly the junior high program.
Oh.
And this was something which was just like they were the scapegoats for a system that was unraveling.
Right.
And the whole community was unraveling in those years. One out of 20 of my peers wouldn't make it to the age of 20 because of a drug-related, alcohol-related car accident, a suicide, a fight with the police, bad health care. This was a rural ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was from Columbia, when I heard that people who had really supported and encouraged me had been fired, I wrote a letter off naming everywhere where the deals were made, the transactions were made in alcohol and drugs, and how people turned another eye to it. And it just blew things up in a way. And I did it from afar because I was in Columbia at the time.
Okay, so let's backtrack.
Sure.
And how did you end up going off in high school to be an exchange student in Columbia?
Because my older siblings all went to college, and one of them had the fortune of being, when my father died, he was a scoutmaster, and my older brother was an Eagle Scout at that point. And the people in town said to him, "We're going to get him launched," because his dad would have gotten him launched.
Mm-hmm.
And they got him an appointment to the Air Force Academy and into Harvard. His application to Harvard was burned in the riots in 1968. Mm. And so the admissions office at Harvard called and talked to the principal, a different principal at the high school, and they agreed to admit him with a full scholarship based on that interview.
Oh, wow.
That telephone interview. And so he went off, and he realized that coming from the Midwest, since I hadn't done anything spectacular, he was a spectacular intellect, a spectacular athlete in three different sports. I mean, he caught people's attentions, but I was this guy who was just kind of working, and I was a drum major, but I didn't have the credentials. So he said, "You need to do something, and going to be an exchange student will get their attention."
Right.
Winning the Betty Crocker Family Leader of Tomorrow Award also got their attention. That was a very different, which I was the first man in male in my school to ever do that.
Wow.
Because I understood the dynamics of a family and the economy of a family system.
Sure.
And when you took the written test, I aced it.
Uh-huh.
So that's how I ended up. I knew that I needed to do something important. And I read 100 Years of Solitude.
Ah,
and I absolutely, yes. That book was just incredible.
Sure.
Effect on me in terms of the physical passion, the intensity, the idealism and the futility of it all. That made me think about things. But it didn't give me a sense of direction. It gave me a sense of engagement.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you do down in Columbia?
I went to classes with the family that I stayed with, and the woman in the family recognized very early on that I had more in common with their maids and their drivers and their farm workers than I did with them. He was a trained ophthalmologist. He'd done his residency at Columbia Eye Institute. And these kids most of them were fluent in English. And so I had to kind of make them not speak English to me.
Sure.
So I could learn Spanish, but I didn't know how to hold silverware properly.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know not to pick my nose or pick my teeth.
Right.
I didn't know any of the mannerisms. So my Colombian mother said, "I'm going to send you to school in the morning, but at lunch, when you come home for lunch, you're going to stay with me and you're going to learn a few things you need to know."
To be a cultured
person. To be a cultured person. So she taught me the things that I had never learned mm-hmm. growing up, even though I had learned a lot, but right. I needed these other skills.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, at least in her opinion.
Well, I mean, I you know, I did in order to be acceptable. I didn't realize how funny they found me until sure. one of their children ended up as an exchange student in Ithaca, and he told stories about me that were just that I didn't realize how much they laughed at me, you know. But and it's good that I didn't, because yeah. there would have been such a level of shame or fear on some
interesting
level. But anyway, the other piece that Jazzman, the song, kind mm-hmm. of pulls out for me is I've had a lifelong connection to the African-American community and to the secular Jewish community in a way that that song in some sense almost prefigured.
Okay.
Partly because of the role of preaching and music in the Black tradition.
Right.
And I can preach like a Pentecostal pastor uh-huh. if that needs to happen, and it's authentic. And but it's not play acting.
Right.
You know. But as a chaplain, you need to be able to provide the words from Judaism or Islam or Pentecostalism or whatever that
and
people find comforting.
And draw on that energy.
And draw on that energy. Right. Yes. Because that's the energy that will help open a door for mm-hmm. healing mm-hmm. or for coping. Mm-hmm. And so those have been pieces that I really treasure about it. And my peers were saying something positive, mm-hmm. and in my own self-doubt, I was taking it as a judgment.
Right.
And that was wrong.
Yeah.
But as an adult, much later, further down the road, I can see it with much more clarity.
Sure. It's always hard at the moment.
Yeah. And it's awkward.
Yeah.
And when I left, I was seeking something, but when I blew the whistle on some of this bad behavior, that even the local physician said, "I can confirm everything mm-hmm. your son has written," he said to my right. mother, uh-huh. "but I can't say it in public
sure.
because I have to live here."
Right.
And so I felt like I was being driven out.
Okay.
And many times psychologically, people who leave rural America end up painting it as more conservative or more rough than it was
right.
because it's the way to cope with leaving something that you loved.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Uh-huh. You make it bad or you make it worse than it was. And mine was bad enough.
Right.
But you make it, you distance yourself so emotionally you can cut the tie to something that is profoundly meaningful.
Sure. Sure. And especially if it's the only thing you've ever known.
Right. 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 And five generations of my ancestors are buried within 6 miles of each other.
Uh-huh.
It's like, not only did I know it, only know it. Yeah.
So let's move forward,
sure.
accelerate a little. So you left rural America and you moved out. Came
right.
Where?
Right. I came to Cornell.
Okay.
After the exchange, the student experience. And when I came to Cornell, you know, I ran for University Senate back when it controlled the non-academic budget of the university. Got a seat on it in 6 candidates. I got 49% of the vote, which, you know, that was kind of big for a small town hayseed.
Mm-hmm.
I took a 6-credit course and 2 3-credit courses. The 6-credit course was reading and writing in the humanities about autobiography and urban life, which was a completely
sure.
different thing for
yeah,
me.
Absolutely.
It opened up stuff. But I did really well in small courses, and I'd never really learned to study because I was doing the assignment for the next day as they were finishing class that day, so I didn't have to do any work when
uh-huh.
I was out working.
Uh-huh.
First semester, wonderful in the fact that I could kind of push my way through it. And then when I had to take large lecture courses and when I got lonely, I realized that my reaction to Cornell and to Ithaca was there are no people here.
Uh-huh.
And by that I mean something very, very specific. There are the people at Cornell at the time I perceived were treating me as a student, and they would only relate to me as there being a professor or a department secretary or coordinator or somebody in an official capacity. People did not relate to each other as people. And I grew up in an environment where you had official roles and there were times you pulled into them, but you also met them as a community equal.
As a person first.
As a person first.
Right.
And you shared of your life with them mm-hmm. so that they would share with you. So what this does for a kid who comes out of a strong community...
You were introduced to an institution.
I was introduced to an institution.
Right.
And for a person whose orientation to life involves community, mm-hmm. where people share their real mm-hmm. experience, institutions are dangerous places. They're dangerous places because you never know what's true.
Right.
You never know what's real. You never know what you can. And they have all of these elaborate systems of rules and codes of conduct and stuff. But they, you know, somehow some people don't abide by those and others do. But there's all of this armor and game face that we wear in an institutionalized setting. Right. And Ithaca, being a company town where manufacturing was still dominant when I came in 1976 in terms of employment, and having a very hierarchical university, was an institutionalized town.
Right.
And I did not realize the source of my pain. And I had a guest on the show who said once, "It sounds like you were very lonely." And I said, "Yeah. But in a certain profound sense, that's blaming the victim."
Right.
So what I needed to learn how to live with my existential loneliness, which means grow up and to know that you'll be all right in a whole bunch of different circumstances. But institutions that don't allow persons to really engage as persons and don't encourage that.
Well, and in fact, are threatened by
it. Are threatened by it, but they are themselves a threat to the very people they want to serve.
Right.
Which are oftentimes fairly vulnerable late teen and early 20 people who don't have that formed sense of self.
Yeah, which actually, I mean, when you consider the suicide rate around here.
And that's what happens when people don't have connection.
Right.
And community is all about that direct
connection. There's no safety net.
Right, right. So I needed to learn how to navigate formal institutions and how not to look at I mean, where I came from, if you saw somebody dressed in a suit or putting on airs, is what we called it in our traditional rural idiom, you knew you could not trust them, that you were emotionally and physically and financially in danger around people like that.
Right.
And it creates this, what people would describe as the same response to racism in your physical response.
Yeah.
So I eventually lost 40 pounds, dropped down to 125, was not functioning, was flunking out, and said, "I am going to stay here and I'm going to figure out how my peers do what I have no clue how to do." And I just watched them, and I worked construction, which was back to my roots, and did some painting, and I watched for 9 months, and after about 7 months I said, "I think I can do it." So I went back and I finished.
You want to listen to more music?
We should take a break for music. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. What we're going to play now is a tune by Dispatch called "General." I'll explain why that's an important tune.
All right.
Later.
There was a decorated general with a heart of gold that likened him to all the stories he told of past battles won and lost and legends of old. A seasoned veteran in his own time, on the battlefield he gained respectful fame with many medals of bravery and stripes to his name. He grew a beard as soon as he could to cover the scars on his face and always urged his men on. But on the eve of a great battle with the infantry and dream, the old general tossed in his sleep and wrestled with its meaning. He awoke from that night to tell what he had seen and walked slowly out of his tent. All the men held tall with their chests in the air, with the courage in their blood and a fire in their stare. And it was a gray morning and they all wondered how they would fare. So the old general told them to go home. He said, "I have seen the others and I have discovered that this fight is not worth fighting. And I've seen their mothers and I will not follow me where I'm going. So take a shower and shine your shoes. You got no time to lose. As you are young men, you must be living. Take a shower and shine your shoes. You got no time to lose. As you are young men, you must be living. Go now, you are forgiven." Yeah. But the men stood fast with their guns on their shoulders, not knowing what to do with the contradicting orders. The general said he would do his own duty, but he would extend it no further. The men could go as they pleased, but not a man moved. Their eyes gazed straight ahead till one by one they stepped back, and not a word was said. And the old general was left with his own words echoing in his head. He then prepared to fight. He said, I have seen the others, and I have discovered that this fight is not worth fighting. No, and I've seen their mothers, and I will no other to follow me where I'm going. So take a shower and shine your shoes. Oh, you got no time to lose. You are young men, you must be living. Yeah, take a shower and shine your shoes. Oh, you got no time to lose. You are young men, you must be living. Go now, you are forgiven. Go now, you are forgiven. Go now, you are forgiven. Go. Yeah. Go now, you are forgiven. Go now, you are forgiven. Go now, you are forgiven. Go.
So I am Jonathan Hochberg here on the Made of Clay Report, interviewing Eric Clay this time to find out a little bit about how he ended up doing this show, ultimately. we're a ways away from that part of the conversation. And before we talk specifically about this song, you mentioned that you, when you were running into problems dealing with your integration into the institutional environment that you found yourself mm-hmm. at Cornell, that you achieved that integration by watching your peers and studying what they were doing mm-hmm. in order to succeed. And I'd like to get a sense of first of all, how you came to the conclusion that that was the right thing to do
mm-hmm.
and where you had picked up the skills to do it.
I guess my community roots, rural roots, emphasize we make the life we live. So if we don't like the life we live, then we have to figure out another way to make a different sort of life. And because the community was really diverse morally and really diverse, we had a lot of freedom to play with ideas and even some behavior. I mean, the congregation I grew up in had a lesbian couple and a gay male couple in it. They weren't super out there, but people, you know, this was a very different kind of world from what our stereotype is of rural America. So I was also, so what I had done before I took the leave of absence in the fourth semester at Cornell, and I left halfway through the fifth, is I had started a study of advisor-advisee relationships in the anthropology department.
Mm.
And so I'm a hardcore intellectual, but I'm sure. Also about relationships and how do you right. study relationships and how do you respond to relationships okay. and intervene. What I saw when I interviewed, and I got a statistically significant response from faculty and students, from first year freshmen to, you know, ending grad students and faculty of all ranks. And what I saw was that the closeness of, you know, the students don't feel very close. They don't feel very close to their advisors when they start their study, mm-hmm. and professors don't feel very close to them. But when they are graduating as majors in their senior year and their first year of graduate school, there's a lot of closeness. But then it begins to fall apart as they begin to differentiate and, mm-hmm. and to take off as independent scholars at the end of their doctoral study.
Okay.
And so I knew that there was a dynamic that was going on there, but I took an incomplete in the course because I couldn't analyze the material. And partly that was my, you know, but the attitude that I could have, and this was before we had review boards that wouldn't have allowed me to study my peers.
Right.
But this was, and it was a very useful study, but I've always been that way. I want to reflect. I want to do it empirically. I want to do it analytically, but I'm also getting at questions that are more aesthetic or spiritual or meaning oriented that you can't put in a box.
Right.
And I was just living that way. That's the only way I've ever known to live. And when I've tried to put myself in a box, a smaller box, usually an institutional box, I don't stay within the role. And that's scary to people who are...
We're starting to see some themes here.
Yeah, yeah.
But we'll come back to them. So let's talk about the song that we just played.
This is listed by Dispatch as their kind of anti-war song, but it's so much more than an anti-war song. And kind of in their fantasy world, it was set as kind of the Civil War. And the Civil War, you know, in my particular religious tradition, the leaders, they were the only major U.S. tradition other than Catholics that didn't split on North-South lines for the Civil War. And the key leaders said, setting slaves free will not make them equal. We have to do a lot of work for that to happen. And turning banks and railroads loose on the economy will not make poor people any more secure. And so that kind of analytical stuff was behind my understanding. When this old general decides he's not going to send all these young people who should be making their own lives, there are two things that to me are going on in this song. One is that he realizes he has an agency that he doesn't have to manipulate other people to take on his issue. There is something that he can do uniquely that belongs to him, and the purpose of his life is fulfilling that in that moment, and he doesn't need to coerce or rally up all these forces, because that's oftentimes just escalating the violence, and we do it in all of our own lives. And people, in order to feel like they can shape the life they live, they need to be sent back, in a certain sense, to start over. If you're not happy with where you are now, how will you make the life you live? Go and shine your shoes and go and take care of your responsibilities and celebrate with your family. But, you know, being locked in conflict because this institution says you should be.
Right.
Even if it's, you know, whether you're on the far left or the far right now,
sure,
it does not matter. The organizing and the escalation on both sides is damning. And we need, in a certain sense, leaders or people who can do it themselves and who take up the task to do it themselves. There is a traditional prayer in Christianity that I value very much, and it's do not pray for easy lives. And I would say do not pray, do not beg, do not, you know, grovel for easy lives, but rather pray or beg or demand greater strength so you can live the life you've been given.
Right. Yeah.
And in my work, that's what it's about, is to try to help people discover through the input of others to see themselves as they are seen. So I can see the boy who was incredibly inadequate in kind of more cultured settings. I need to be fluent in a whole lot of different settings. Just being a farm boy, which is I am, is not the only thing I am.
Right.
You know.
And it isn't enough for you to be.
And it isn't enough for anybody to be one thing.
Right.
You know. So the way this kind of coalesces in something like my radio show, The Made of Clay Report, is I want people to see the struggles in the lives of local residents so they can value, respect, and understand experience that may be different than their own and may be similar in surprising ways. And we don't know each other. Part of the legacy of Danning in a highly institutionalized town is we don't have this ease of just, who are you? You know, we don't just say that, tell me about yourself, unless we have a formal occasion for doing so. So the radio show is the chance for people to eavesdrop on a personal conversation that's not private.
So let's sort of get a circle closed here.
Sure.
You grew up in a community which, as you said, was at the time a fairly typical rural community, which from today's perspective, one would think would be closed-minded and conservative with a capital
C. Right.
And yet you describe it as being an open and fairly compassionate and forgiving community.
Right.
And an accepting community. And you talked about lesbian couples and stuff. The point there, it seems to me, is that there was a fundamental live and let live. You talked about it, sort of an anarchist sort of...
Right, but more than live and let live, if you see anybody not living, help pick them up.
Sure.
And you don't have to like them or agree with them, but to help make sure that they can live.
As you said, make sure that your adversary has the has the resources to do that.
Well, I sensed that things were going bad when I was bagging the groceries of the guy who was the local slaughterer. He would go out on the farm and kill the steer or the animal, the large animal, and gut it, and then take it and cut it up and give it back to you.
Sure.
If you needed to hire it done, if you didn't do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he was saying to me as he was checking out, I don't know why I should pay more in school taxes for you, because all you're going to do is take my money and you're going to leave here and you're going to make a life for yourself and you're not ever coming back, and none of your siblings ever came back and nobody ever comes back.
Well, which was true.
Which was true. And but that was the beginning of my awareness of the level of visceral rejection of the outside world from these rural communities.
Which had not been there, but which was now growing.
Yes. And it had been among some people there, but not among the majority.
And it was a reaction to the outside world rejecting them.
Right, right. And making fun of them and using, and hee-haw was a double-edged sword. And a lot of people didn't get the satire of All in the Family. And it was just, it was kind of a crazy moment in history where things flipped. And that's what flipped, I think, that led to the problems that we have now politically.
So you think that's that is the foundation of the polarization?
I think that was we couldn't avoid it after that moment. Mm-hmm. We might have avoided it earlier, but with the assassinations in the late 60s and with the mocking and Watergate, which kind of gave liberals a good reason to mock,
and also gave people a good reason to have a lack of trust.
And a lack of trust. And also poor people watching very angry African Americans destroy what assets they had in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
That created, I understand it. I've gone and studied in neighborhoods in Chicago and Detroit where that happened, and where people tried to rebuild the wealth. But the reaction among the whites was, I mean, in the church that I grew up in, the language of brother and sister with something very as close to a African American accent as you can talk about.
Right.
And after that time, they no longer used the language.
Mm-hmm.
Because they wanted to distance themselves from urban and black culture.
Right.
And I grew up not wanting that to happen.
Mm-hmm. That actually does segue nicely into where you ended up.
Right, right.
Because you went back, you finished up at Cornell.
Right, right.
After taking this hiatus.
Yeah.
And you had done so having now accumulated the personal tools necessary to succeed.
I wish.
Well, it was your goal to do so.
Yeah, yeah. It was my goal. I worked with some really great people, and I got to be a college scholar because of my first semester's performance was so great, and it didn't matter how bad some of the later semesters were, and then they were good. But I got to do a senior project which looked at three views of reproduction and abortion in the U.S., and there are three, not two. One is the kind of the right to life position, which is just a restating of patriarchy in disguise, and then there's the right to privacy, which is just a mere flip of the hierarchy, and then there's this reproductive equity. That has this sense that every child on a certain level needs to be born into an environment where there are half a dozen or a dozen people committed to that child's well-being, not just a mother's decision.
Right.
So the decision may ultimately be the woman's because that's in her body, but it's also a decision that needs to be affirmed and arrived at with the work of other people who will be impacted by it.
Almost the ultimate of it takes a village to raise its
child. Right, and it takes a village to understand sexual behavior that's not manipulative or abusive.
Yes.
Anyway, and I want to back up here because this connects to some of the group work that I do.
Mm-hmm.
So in what I wanted to do coming out of Cornell was holistic community development. What I have discovered that to be is through shared journeys, which is... sharing the journey in all dimensions of your life.
Sure.
And because I didn't go to law school or medical school, as a pastor, I could have access to many dimensions of people's lives, or as a journalist in this way, you get access to. it's a role that, so I offer groups where people get to meet each other, and I want those groups to be places where they can really hear each other and where it's safe. But we have people coming at these groups from two different points of view that are completely antithetical to each other. One is this protected privacy, highly confidential, you know, whatever's said here never leaves here, and I will only give you what I feel like it's safe enough to give you. That person needs to feel safe. Mm-hmm. But a person who is community oriented, they want to be able to share with tremendous depth the specifics of their lives, and many of them are not very good at it, so they end up oversharing. And so you've got this tension that mm-hmm. can be explosive. But I want the group to be safe for both, because they each need to learn the other's skills.
Sure.
And yet they need to learn more than the skills. You know what I mean? In terms of having to really pursue each other's agenda.
Right. Yeah,
but you've got to get past this style issue, which makes the process somewhat unsafe. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of my group work, and some groups are topical, like I'll be starting up a topical group in December addressing what I call hillbilly politics or hillbilly dreams, from nightmares to opportunities, and how can we reframe our understanding from a nightmare to what could be an opportunity that we could be more collaborative around.
Sure.
And while I didn't grow up as a hillbilly, it's real close.
Right.
You know, the Ozarks are not far away from where I grew up. The other one is about surviving the holidays and how you can keep your sense of humor. So I'm going to be trying to bring people together to talk about these things and those topical groups. And that's where people who are intellectual or a little bit skittish about groups can kind of test the waters. Mm-hmm. But I offer other groups that are called creative life groups or aging well groups, where people just, they come there ready and willing to share about, this is what I'm struggling with, or this is what I'm happy about, or this is what I really want to do, even though I'm 80 years old and it doesn't look like I have it in me to make that trail hike. Mm-hmm. You know, so how do we think about it?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we live the lives that we want to live? Mm-hmm. So that's how it works into my group work.
Now, the use of community conversation,
mm-hmm.
as a tool,
right,
to bring individuals forward, what made you feel like you were equipped to do that?
My peers labeled me the jazz man.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I had figured that was where we were going to end up.
But I figured
I should ask.
Yeah. No, and but it's one of the things that I had to learn to do was, you have to ask an open-ended question where you genuinely care about the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And the minute you give a person a chance to define what they speak to that matters to them, they're committed.
Sure.
And as long as you never coerce it. You know, coercion is how institutions operate, by the threat of withdrawal of affirmation or the selective giving of it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in a high functioning community, you just step in with what you have for what other people need.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter whether you agree or share mm-hmm. culture or religion or race or any of it, because you're there. You're fully present and accounted for. We just, you know, we don't know how to navigate those boundaries very well.
It strikes me that that's, you know, you say we don't know how to navigate those boundaries very well, and it feels like the obvious next word is anymore.
Well, this is where romanticism is the death of us.
Right.
In the past, there may have been places, and I grew up in a place where we did it well some of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But also, when the first black family tried to buy a farmhouse in the community where mm-hmm. I lived in the 60s, mm-hmm. somebody who was extremely, not even extremely racist, but racist, burned it down before they could move in. But we had a lot of poor whites moving in, mm-hmm. and they were poor whites who were sexually abusing their children.
Right.
And there were lots of issues coming because they could no longer function in urban America or be hidden.
Right.
But they could be hidden in rural America.
Right, right, right.
So there were problems. And there were problems with gender relationships and gender inequality.
Okay.
You know, it is not idyllic, but we know the struggle we need to be engaged in. And that's what the general's about.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you think that the current tide of exposure of social inequities, power inequities, that has arisen out of the recent political tide change. Do you think that that is a reflection of an overall maturing of our ability to confront these things, or do you think this is just a knee-jerk reaction that is going to fade as soon as the news cycle is over?
So I think most of what we're seeing is intellectual, which is not grounded in our bodies and our visceral responses to thing. So you can have an analytical policy oriented, you know, I have a PhD in city and regional planning and in economic policy and whatnot. It does not help to intellectually understand something where you need to be able to have a relationship across a difference. It does help to make policy, but a lot of times what we're doing is organizing for a way to get our legislation or our rules over 51%. And so these times are not helping us.
Okay.
These times are creating an idea that we can organize around what we're seeing.
But I'm talking specifically even just about having the conversation, which we were not engaged in for a variety of reasons, but primarily because the power differential made it impossible to have.
Right. So the issue that I would say with that is, if we're having the conversation for intellectual purposes, it's a dead end.
Okay.
If we're saying to each other, how can I help you and how can you help me? If we're actually making it an exchange of resources that's implied in that conversation, then there's value to it. And that's the difference between, and we're talking about here what I would call covenant, and I refer to that often in the show, where we do for others what they cannot do for themselves, and where we ask from others what we cannot do for ourselves. And I can't pay you back what I didn't earn in the first place, you know, and you can't pay it back to me. So, but institutions are run on contracts. And so if we can use this moment to move the conversation over to how we do this, it will be good. And a lot of people, I'm going to anticipate an issue here. A lot of people want to reject what I'm saying as being just individualism, people acting kind of on their own. When we set up expectations about how people treat each other, where they offer and where they step in, and it's not necessarily a contract, but it's a community way of doing the structural work. If you want to do the structural work from a institutional way, you do it in a different way. You create absolute laws and you create contracts and you create all of those structures that keep institutions strong. We need institutions to create the structures that our lives are built on, but they're also the scaffolding on which we'll be lynched, whether we're white or black or green, because that's what institutions do when they fall apart, and they will. Communities fall apart in terms of gossip and how they constrain people around the use of gossip and information, but high-functioning communities match needs and resources really quickly because of the communication structures. So in that sense, communication is the way out. I'm rambling, but
no, that's okay. Because I think that the work that you do has a local relevance, but it's in a national context,
right?
And the as you build knowledge of this kind of community structure on a local level, it has the potential to ripple outwards.
Right. And we have been able to do that. Shared Journeys, my organization, is the fiscal sponsor for Ithaca Mobile Pack, which brings Feed My Starving Children, which brings together this year 1,700 people to pack over 300,000 meals. We've packed 2,250,000 meals in the past 8 years for kids who would not have food in very dangerous places around the world or very impoverished places. We've gotten that food to be certified halal. The founding organization is a fairly conservative Christian service organization, and they, you know, pushing to have it certified halal. There was something they wanted to do, so that 30-40% of the countries that they serve are Muslim dominant countries, and they wanted it accessible, but they had to sell it to their base. We also have Jewish participants and Muslim participants here in Ithaca, and because we brought together those people, we could leverage this national or international process. With McCormick Community is with the McCormick Secure Center, which is a maximum security prison for male youth, male teenagers mostly, in Caroline, and Finger Lakes Residential Center, which is medium security. We provide the support for the community advisory boards there to try to bring community to these kids who have been incarcerated and to try to model that. So we're trying not just on a local level, but to find ways to push it out.
Sure.
You know. Yes. And it's and every time I talk about it, yeah. it becomes that. And there is yet another piece, which is, you know, I need to sit with people individually about what's going on in their lives sometimes. But what I've found is most of the work people need to do is in groups.
Yeah.
Groups of their choosing.
Sure.
Where they pick, you know, where they pick, choose to be with people who aren't just like them. Maybe not completely opposite, because that can be a really hard thing to bridge.
Right.
And you can't have groups that are too heavily facilitated, or you never learn the skills yourself.
Right.
But stepping out of that group individually from time to time, which is what I do in my another hat of coaching and counseling, is allows for people to work through things with an intimacy that they don't necessarily feel that they have in a larger group setting.
Sure. And so while no man is an island,
right,
it helps to be alone sometimes.
Yeah. And to be affirmed or be challenged where that is a deeply one-on-one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Do you want to get one more piece of music in?
Sure. I thought we would close with a piece that shows kind of more where I am growing into, and it's a piece by Kate Wolfe, who died back in the late 80s, and it's been covered by many other people. It's called Give Yourself to Love. I've had a lot of energy, a lot of curiosity, a lot of fight in me. I'm a bit of a warrior. The general song is about really being careful about what I'm doing and where I need other people, and really don't need to pull other people in, because I can make an impact.
Right.
You know, and this Give Yourself to Love is about trying to get clear, emotionally clear, and to be honest about mm-hmm. it, but also to be open to being challenged when people question, is it less than love?
Sure.
And that's an important piece of my life.
Kate Wolfe.
Thanks.
Kind friends all gathered round, something I would say, that what brings us together here has blessed us all today. Love has made a circle that holds us all inside, for strangers are as family, loneliness can't hide. You must give yourself to love. Love is what you're after. Open up your hearts to the tears and laughter, and give yourself to love. Give yourself to love. I've walked these mountains in the rain. I've learned to love the wind. I've been up before the sunrise to watch the day begin. And I always knew I'd find you, though I never did know how. But like sunshine on a cloudy day, stand before me now. So give yourself to love. Love is what you're after. Open up your hearts to the tears and laughter, and give yourself to love. Give yourself to love. Love is born in fire, planted like a seed. Love can't give you everything, but it gives you what you need. And love comes when you are ready. Love comes when you're afraid.
It will be your greatest teacher, the best friend you have made. So give yourself to love. Love is what you're after. Open up your hearts to the tears and laughter, and give yourself to love. Give yourself to love. Give yourself to love. If love is what you're after, open up your hearts to tears and laughter, and give yourself to love. Give yourself to love.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this has been the Made of Clay Report, and Jonathan Hochberg has been our my co-host today, are interviewing me. Jonathan, are we going to... usually we close with a song, but was there something else you wanted to ask before we sign off?
No, I think that... I think mostly you have evolved the tools that you have employed all your life to reach this point, where you are applying it both on a, as you said, an individual and a community level, but you are bringing that that skill to this show to provide a wealth of behavioral study and psychological study that is a great service to the community.
Thank you.
And so I am always interested to hear where your conversations go. And it was very fun to be able to take part in it this time.
Thank you. And I want to, we had a conversation while the music was playing that Jonathan was saying, the being able to speak to certain issues of racism, sexism, inequality, being able to speak is actually at the national level, and the way these things are batting around is beginning to create more open spaces down below. And I do get that.
Yeah, and I think it goes in both directions. I really do. I think that the, you know, there was a period where the ubiquity of mass communication created a real tension, which actually came to a head with this last election cycle, where you had people who were not supposed to be part of the conversation influencing the conversation in detrimental ways.
Very
fact that we are able to now, you know, introspectively look at that and say, you know, this is a conversation that we need to have ourselves on a personal and community level, rather than have it be directed by national forces.
Right.
The important thing.
Right. And the way you have just said that, it's a conversation between ourselves,
right,
where fake news goes off the table, but
right,
also a commitment to facts that may actually be true, but they're not helpful.
Right.
Because they don't put the context for us to really understand. That context we can work out in conversation.
That's right.
Thank you, Jonathan.
My pleasure. Thank you, Eric.
You can find more out about my work at madeofclay.org for all of the shows on WRFI, as well as at sharedjourneys.net, where you can learn about the groups that I run and the counseling and coaching services that I offer. You can correspond to me directly through either of those websites. Thank you.